Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisby.
I'm Kirsty Dill.
And this is the podcast about reading books at the right time. Kirsty, what have you been reading on time this week?
Not on time, not remotely on time, in fact, less on time than the books we're actually talking about today as part of the podcast. I accidentally read The Reluctant Fundamentalist by Mohsin Hammoud this
week. Hang on, I'm just going to stop you there. How do you accidentally read a book?
Well, I'll tell you. I will tell you how I accidentally read a book. I did not set out to read it, but I was in a charity shop, as I am wont to do, in the book section, and then accidentally buying some, as one does. It was only £1.99. In fact, not even. I think it was 99p.
And I hate to point this out to you, Kirsty, but you can't accidentally buy books.
Well, again,
I know that's what you're telling yourself.
It wasn't. I didn't set out to buy books, but accidentally came home with three. You know the way. Anyway, one of the books was The Reluctant Fundamentalist by Mohsin Hammoud, film tie-in edition, which I normally hate, but that's what they had. That's fine. And this was published by Hamish Hamilton in 2007. It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize that year. I didn't read it then, obviously. But I got home and I sort of had a flick through it, and I sort of, I'll read the first few pages and then accidentally read the whole thing. And it's like, oh, well, now I've read it. That was efficient of me. Bought it, read it the same day I bought it. That so rarely happens.
Well, medal for that.
Thanks. So not late to it in terms of purchase. I'd read it within, 6 hours of buying it, but it was quite a number of years after it came out. So, and as I said, it was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. So no doubt that lots of people listening to this will have read it or seen the film with Riz Ahmed in it and Kiefer Sutherland and Liv Schreiber and all this sort of stuff. Anyway, if you haven't read it, it's all narrated by a man. We're in a cafe in Lahore in Pakistan, and an American is in this cafe with our narrator, who says right on the first page, I am a lover of America. I see I've alarmed you. Don't be frightened by my beard. I am a lover of America. And then he sits down and starts talking to the American and starts telling his story. And it is at first glance a kind of American dream type story. Young Pakistani man has managed to get to college in the States. He is extremely bright. He works incredibly hard. He kind of gets involved in student life. He goes on holiday. He's in with all the kind of rich set, although he himself is not rich. He's working incredibly hard and trying to stay afloat and keep up with his classes and everything. But he's in with this sort of very rich crowd, and they go on holiday together, and it's all, very shiny American college. He goes off and gets a job at this consultancy that sort of values companies, basically. Goes, it gets brought in, and a company is potentially going to be sold and values it. It's all very financial, capitalism, all of that sort of stuff. He falls in love with a woman called Erica, an American woman. But then 9/11 happens, and as he watches the American invasion of Afghanistan and so on and so forth, he sort of gets disillusioned with America. And at the same time, his girlfriend Erica is I take issue with the way on the back of the book it says that he is betrayed by an American woman. And I take issue with that. She's obviously she's traumatized by the death of her ex-partner, her first boyfriend. And clearly the start of this relationship with him has triggered this trauma to kind of reassert itself. And so she breaks up with him. I feel a bit, doesn't feel quite like a betrayal. It feels a bit, was a bit judgmental, but anyway, so he goes back, he leaves his job and goes back to Pakistan and becomes the reluctant fundamentalist, basically. It's very, very, I mean, obviously compelling in that I picked up the first few pages and then read the whole book. It is quite a short book, but it's not, it's I mean, my edition's 200 pages. And it's excellent. It's really, really excellent. It's that, it's the way that he tells the narrative and, you know, points out all the things that the American that he's speaking to might find uncomfortable and explains it all. And, you know, it's just, it's all very, very kind of subtly done. And the ending, which I will not spoil, the ending is very, very well done indeed. And then after having read it, excuse me, I went and looked at the Wikipedia page for the film. Because I was like, oh, I didn't realize it was a film version. Looking at that, the film versions looks to be almost entirely different. there's the basic similarities, but there's at least according to the plot section on the Wikipedia page, there is quite a vast difference between the two. So they may be both equally enjoyable, but if you've seen the film and haven't read the book, I would say read the book, because it looks to be entirely different.
I have neither seen the film nor read the book, but the book is on my bookshelf and has been for some time. However, it does sound interesting. I do want to read Exit West first, which is one of his later books, which I want to read more than that one, because it's got a bit of a magic realist element to it. Like, as we've discussed, that's my thing. But yes, it does sound good.
It's very good. I'd not read anything by him before. And I mean, I was aware of this book, obviously, had heard of it. It was up for the Booker Prize, etc. And I'd heard of quite a few of his other books, but I just never got around to reading any of them. So it was a total impulse purchase, impulse read. And I thoroughly recommend it. So what about you? What have you been reading?
Well, I am also not up to date either. I've been reading Little by Edward Carey, which I've just looked up because, like you the other week, I have had to take it back to the library, which more on which in a second. But apparently it was published in 2019. Now, I would have sworn to you this book came out in 2020 because I swear it was all over Twitter during lockdown, but who knows? Like,
maybe that's when everyone got around to it.
Yeah. But also time's elastic since pandemic started, so who knows? But yeah, one of my favourite things to do at the moment is to go to the library and browse and pick up books like I am in a bookshop.
Yes.
And this was one of the ones that I picked up quite a while ago, actually. I had it out of the library for about 9 weeks, like a very naughty reader, because I was reading it at bedtime while I was doing lots of chairing. So I was only managing like a few pages before I was falling asleep, so it took me a while to read it. That is no comment on Edward Carey's writing, which was excellent. So, and it's the sort of book I wouldn't normally pick up. So it's basically the story of Madame Tussaud before she became Madame Tussaud.
Right.
And I'm like, historical fiction, no thanks. However, obviously I stood in the library and read the first page. I was like, oh yeah, all right, I'll take it home. And it just grips you straight away, which is great. And so it starts with her when she's very small. I mean, she's called Little because she was always little, but she is very small at the beginning. And her dad dies, and then her mum takes her to go and live with this doctor that she's working for. She's a cleaner for him. And then she dies, and she's left with this doctor. And it turns out that the doctor hasn't actually been going to the hospital to do his work, because they are about to commit him to an institution because he's not well. And so what they do is, instead of allowing him to be taken into the institution and her to then, you know, whatever fate befalls her, they decide to run away. So they leave. I think they're in Bern, and they run away to Paris to find this one guy who once said they should come and visit him in Paris. So that's what they do. And this guy's not expecting them at all, but they manage to get sort of set up in Paris. And so one of the things that the doctor does is create these figures, well, faces, mostly made out of wax. And eventually he teaches Marie to do this. Although when he's in Paris, he takes up with this widow. And they're not romantically involved until like much later on, when it's sort of, it's a bit of a weird relationship, let's put it that way. But she's very controlling about what Marie's allowed to do and not do. And just as far as she's concerned, Marie's just there to be a servant and clean up and all the rest of it. But she sneaks in because she really wants to learn. And there's a whole thing with the widows son Edward, who she's in love with, and he has quite a tragic story. But eventually, like, they lived through the French Revolution, all the rest of it, and they started making models' heads, particularly, but of famous people who pay them for them. And then during the revolution, they end up having to make ones of criminals because they literally, the heads are brought to them and they're told to do it, and they, you know, they're going to die. So it's a really fascinating story, and it takes you right up to the point where she marries and becomes Madame Tussaud. So her husband's a bellend. And so it goes right up to the point where she leaves him and goes to London and sets up Madame Tussaud as we know it. So he skips over that bit of the story because that's sort of the most famous bit. And, you know, you can go at Madame Tussaud's. And although having read how they created the models, and now, you know, sometimes you look at me, you just go, that does not look like whoever it is, because they used to literally put the wax on the face and do a like proper mask from the face. Yeah. But also Edward Carey draws. So if you followed him on any social media, you'll know that, because he did loads of drawings during the pandemic. And there are drawings all the way through the book, which is ace, because he doesn't love pictures in a book, even if you're grown up. So yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's a fascinating story, and he tells it really vividly. And I suppose that's the history that I like the most, the ones where, and I'm sure like the gap, you know, he's filling in gaps that with things that we can't possibly know, but, you know, he tells it in such a sort of colourful way that it's, you can picture it, or I could anyway.
Yeah, that, I mean, like you in The Most Enamoured, I've had that book on my shelf for ages, since it came out probably, and still haven't read it. But yes, I think there should be more pictures in books for grown-ups. I love reading, but also I really like pictures. It's one of the things I loved about when I was reading a lot of Victorian literature, when I was doing my degree and stuff. Dickens, you always got a picture. Love it. Get Boz on.
The only good thing.
A few sketches. I will not rise to that. I love a picture in a book. Bring them back, I say. Mm. If only we knew someone that worked in publishing that, you know, could suggest it. I might suggest it tomorrow. I've got an idea, guys. More pictures.
For ages, yeah. My boyfriend said that he wasn't going to come and see me chair any events because the only question that he wanted to ask was, have you thought about doing a picture book? He did not ask that when he came to watch me chair. Bottled it.
Yeah, I obviously I really want to read it. I've bought the book. But I'm not normally a historical fiction reader, same as you. But I do like anything set in the Victorian period. That's the kind of one sort of thing that I will read. And I'm fascinated with the whole Madame Tussauds thing. I've never actually been, although I really want to go, because just as a concept, it's so weird. Like, I understand that at the time, like, you know, we didn't have access to our celebrities. You know, we didn't see them on television. You know, we didn't have television or anything like that. Or film even, but now in the 21st century, when everyone's on Instagram, and more of that soon when we come on to talk about the books today, but the fact that it's still, I mean, I go past Madame Tussauds in London pretty often because it's on my route to work, so you see people like queued up every day, like queued right along the streets. I would absolutely do it as well. It's just to go and see a wax effigy of a famous person. It's just, it's so weird. I love it, but it's so odd. Yeah, it just baffles me. So I find the whole thing fascinating. I will get to it eventually.
Yeah, it's definitely worth reading. Definitely worth reading.
Excellent. Right, well, on that then, on to two books. So the two books that we're talking about today. So there are some pictures in one of these, but they're not jolly. Not jolly pictures at all. The two books we're talking about.
Some of them are.
Some of them are very much not. We're talking about Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, Intimate Histories of Riotous Black Girls, Troublesome Women and Queer Radicals by Saidiya Hartman. And My Body Keeps Your Secrets, No Pictures, and That's Probably for the Best, by Lucia Osborne Crowley. I think, we didn't discuss this. Are we starting with Wayward Lives?
I think we just sort of went, it didn't matter, so let's go.
Let's go with that, because it's the one I'm holding. Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments was published in the UK by Serpent's Tail in 2019, with the paperback coming out last year in 2021. In fact, both of these books in different ways are acts of reclamation, aren't they? They're about reclaiming and telling our own stories and putting stories back in context. I think Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments is just completely brilliant. It's a work of scholarship, but don't let that sort of academic or scholarly word put you off, because even if you're not in any way an academic reader, it's also just so incredibly written. Essentially what she's done with this book is taken the archives of Black people in America at the beginnings of the 20th century and try to give them their stories back. These are people who, you know, are dispossessed, who have been nameless, who have had their histories kind of stripped from them, who have never been given, you know, we've only ever seen them through the lens of sociologists or psychologists or police records, or, you know, we've seen them at a remove or kind of with a very specific lens on them. And what she's doing is giving them back the complexity of their own lives, I guess. I don't know where you want to start. I mean, there's just so many incredible stories. I mean, some of them are funny, some of them are incredibly tragic. I mean, right at the beginning, we're talking about a young Black girl in a photograph that is essentially child pornography, that she comes across, and she's trying to kind of give that girl her life back. It's incredibly harrowing stuff. But then, you know, later in the book, we have these, you know, joyous lives of people dancing and partying and sexual freedom and, you know, giving them that joy back as well that they've also been denied by the archives, I guess. Where do you want to start? I've just kind of gone blah.
Well, it sort of felt to me like there were two halves to it. I know it's split into more sections than that, but there's the half of the slums and the poverty and people who are realizing that they're in a different type of servitude, that have escaped slavery, or slavery's officially ended, but we've got Jim Crow and horrendous living conditions, and so there's that side of it. Then there's the actors and the dancers and the singers and all that sort of more glamorous lifestyle. But the thing to me that seemed to cross over both was, one, the idea of sexual freedom, which you mentioned, which comes up in both elements. There's lots of talk about promiscuity in terms of women having multiple sexual partners and seeing people when their husbands are husbands who aren't actually their husbands, and that idea of these Black lives being created outside of the law because the law doesn't fit or work for them because of the way they've been classified, which went across both threads, I thought, and was a really interesting thread to read about that sort of sexual freedom in a time where women were supposed to be repressed and not, you know, in tune with their own sexuality or bodies or own experiences, to see that come up again and again and again about, you know, and they were, even within their community to some extent, they were pathologized, but they continued to live in that way because that's how they wanted to live. I thought that was fascinating.
Absolutely. And it sort of worked in two ways, because you've got, yes, you know, as women, you know, they were meant to be, so they were supposed to be repressed and all that sort of stuff. But then you also have this kind of racist trope of the kind of you know, highly sexualized Black people. And on the one hand, there's the, you know, the idea that, well, you know, this is what is expected of them, blah, blah, you know, kind of from an entirely racist standpoint. But then at the same point, you know, they are being monitored, and as you say, kind of put in this kind of under this constant watchfulness and under a law that isn't built for them, or is built specifically to criminalize them. And, you know, so from whatever angle you come at it from, they are living their lives outside of someone's expectations. So you can't, they can't win. They're damned if they do and damned if they don't. And so, you know, creating their own lives on their own terms is sort of the only thing they can do, and sort of also the best rebellion against that, I guess.
Yeah, I was fascinated how many of them were described as married, and then it turned out they weren't actually married. And that idea, which, you know, at the time, I suppose in white society would have been unthinkable, even though the men were all having affairs, like you didn't get divorced, which persisted, you know, for quite a long time. But in this, it was just like, yeah, no, we were done. So I moved on. And
yeah.
And also the amount of kids that got left behind or taken with them, or and just the way that families reshaped themselves. And yeah, I found all that fascinating. And you know, living in the slums, which is grim, but is one of those bits that needs to be written about, doesn't it? And needs to be remembered and shown, and yeah.
And written about in a way that is not just about the misery of them. Because yes, the conditions were absolutely appalling, systemically let down people who were, you know, at the bottom of the heap in society by design, basically, with Jim Crow and so on and so forth. But where they get their joy, you know, the act of joy, the act of finding joy becomes radical. In itself, and actually seeing that from a historical point of view is incredibly important. As you know, this is something it put me in mind of. Was reading, as I did at one point, I read a lot about the East End slums in London in the Victorian, so slightly earlier than this, in the kind of late 19th century, where you had people like Henry Mayhew writing The London Labour and the London Poor. He was a sociologist who went to kind of observe the slums of the East End in London, and he would categorise the poor. You know, you'd have the deserving poor and the undeserving poor, and the, you know, all the flower, you know, and he'd put pictures, obviously, pictures of, you know, the flower seller and blah, 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 an interview. And it ran to like masses and masses of volumes, although there's various sort of condensed volumes you can read now. But there was a huge amount of literature there, you know, The Child of the Jago. There was, I mean, Jack London, the American writer, who's sort of best known for Call of the Wild and White Fang and all that sort of stuff. He went to London in his 20s and wrote a book called The People of the Abyss, which is when he went into the East London slums and lived there for 7 weeks and wrote about the people that he met there. And it's all through this sort of outsider kind of, this outside, you know, in the same way that she's trying to give the people that she's writing about their voices back, because we only see them through the lens of these people that go there to examine them. You know, they're like museum exhibits almost, you know, they're just there as things to be written about and examined, or cautionary tales. And she's kind of reclaiming them from that. You know, there is, you know, the same thing was happening in London in a different way, you know, the kind of the categorization of real living people. Well, it goes on, you know. So I went off on a Victorian rant there. It does happen. It's been happening more and more this season.
No, you just made me think about those two women who did my head in, who I've only written down Helen and Hannah because I can't even be asked to give them the surname. So two white women who move into this slum, who think they're going to, like, you know, reform and you know, social mobility, they're going to sort it all out. And these women are going to do what they want them to do and behave in the way they think they should behave. And it absolutely does not happen.
No.
One of the bits that then really pissed me, because they end up with this, so that's probably the wrong way to phrase it, but this mother comes with her daughter wanting to rent a place, and then it turns out that the daughter's married in inverted commas to someone, but also seeing other men, and that's causing all sorts of problems, including he's being violent towards her at home. But the women think that they're going to sort this out, and that, you know, that somehow they're going to make this all right, and you know, it doesn't happen because the black women continue to rebel, and at one point she feels like they're all ganging up on her, and you're just like, well, and when she doesn't know what to do, she goes to the police, and you're just like, of all the things to do. That's very white woman of you. Well done.
Yeah, completely. It's the white saviour thing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I found it massively frustrating. I was just like, oh,
hugely. Hugely. But then there were other people I love. Edna Thomas and Lady Olivia Wyndham. I just love them. Lady Olivia Wyndham, who threw herself down some stairs to get the attention of a nurse she liked. They were firm friends. I've written down the quote, the firm friends, which is sort of the equivalent of gal pals. Yes, they were firm friends.
Yes, I was like, lives. You mean lesbians?
Yes.
Yeah, they're when I read friends. That, I was just like, "What? Why didn't you just put the lesbians?" But anyway.
Excellent friends, companions for many years.
Yeah, I lived in the same house and everything.
Yeah.
I really friends. Enjoyed Bentley, the trans man.
Yeah. Who love Bentley
dressed up and went out and performed, and
his photos were joyous.
Yes, yes,
beautiful. They were very joyous. And then Billie Holiday turns up as a 14-year-old who's arrested, using the name Eleanor Fagan at that point. It's her grandmother's name, I think. Might have misremembered that. Anyway, she turns up at one point. It's fascinating that the kind of people that that show up, and some of it is harrowing, you know, some of it is, you know, people who have been, you know, sexually assaulted and used and goodness knows what, and as you say, in various different types of servitude, but it's done in such a way that it is not kind of relentless, you know. It's not one of those things that it's just kind of, I think sometimes if you're writing about, I mean, come on to this in a minute when we talk about the other book, when you're writing about this sort of litany of trauma, it can become very tiring to read and very difficult to read, but she does it in such a way that it's incredibly readable for such a kind of epic work of scholarship.
Yeah, I just want to go back a little bit, because when you mentioned Billie Holiday, it reminded me of this. So she appears very briefly to start with, and one of the things that, so she's been arrested for prostitution, which is what lots of black women in this book get arrested for, because anytime they're having sex with anybody, they seem to get arrested for prostitution, because that's what the white policemen can charge them with.
Yeah. Because
how dare they have sex? And it says, when the young Billie Holiday appeared before the women's court after being arrested in a disorderly house, the 14-year-old Eleonora Harris gave her name as Eleanor Fagan, which was her grandmother's surname, and pretended she was 21 in order to avoid a custodial sentence of 3 years at the reformatory in favour of a short stint at the workhouse. As she had hoped, the judge, Jean Norris, sentenced her to 4 months in the workhouse at Blackwell's Island. This sentence was a month longer than the sentence received by the neighbour who raped her when she was 11.
Yep. It's, yeah.
It stopped me when I read it. In the midst of, you know, quite a lot of grim things happening, that one stopped me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That, I mean, the idea of kind of future criminality comes up several times. People being picked up, not because they have done something wrong, but because the police think they will do something wrong.
Does that not happen? I mean, I'm thinking about black people getting stopped by traffic police, or, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, that's the sort of my point in that kind of, it's still going on. I mean, we look at it in books like this and go, my God, it's horrendous. But actually, it's exactly what's still going on here in America, you know, in other parts of the world, where, you know, I read a book earlier this year, because I full disclosure, because I was working on it, about what's happening in China to the Uyghurs. And you know, they're using face recognition technology to pick people who look Uyghur or Uzbek, because they're on the border, out of crowds, and just pull them up for it's exactly that, the kind of future criminality. This happens around the world constantly in so many different ways, and it is all around people who are, you know, the kind of status quo of society finds them undesirable in some way. And it's one thing to read it in the past and go, God, that's awful. Mm. But it's still happening.
Mm. Yeah. We seem to spend more time talking about the grim bits, but I partly just want people to go, and, because if we talk about the like bits that are fun, it feels a lot quicker to talk about, you know what I mean? Like we'd sort of go, well, this and this and this. And I'm like, yeah. I want people to go and read it, like read it, you know, we'll leave the fun bits as teasers.
Fun bits to look forward to. There are some incredible photos towards the end of the book where it's talking about the chorus, you know, this idea of the chorus, which are all these unnamed black women that she kind of uses in a kind of Greek chorus in a way. It's sort of synthesizing their voices. And I think actually that's one thing I did want to say about this. Any of us, anyone listening to this that has studied at university, undergraduate, postgraduate, whatever, you know, we have it drummed into us, or certainly I had it drummed into me, about you use the sources. Like it's all about the sources and what the archives say and what have you. And of course the archives only represent those who have been recorded. It's, you know, the things we've talked about before, it's history is, you know, who's telling the story, essentially, is the question we always have to ask ourselves, and why are they telling it? So for an academic to kind of fill in the gaps with, I mean, fiction to an extent, but what she thinks would be the most likely, you know, some speculation, some sort of fictionalized ideas of what some of these people, their lives might have been like, feels like that feels like a radical thing in and of itself. And it's because the archives aren't there, it's because those voices aren't recorded, that we have to use our imagination to a certain extent, which I just thought was a really interesting kind of thing in and of itself.
Yeah, I think she tells the stories really brilliantly. They're really engaging and captivating, and she's obviously filled gaps in where there's things missing, but it reads, none of it read like it was untrue or fictionalized in any way. It was real. Yeah, and also I have a massive problem with, you know, what's considered scholarship and what isn't, when, you know, it's just self-perpetuating middle-class white people. Soz, but it is. Yeah, because, you know, you get pulled up for going, well, that's not scholarly. And you're just like, well, there isn't anything, because nobody's produced that thing that you're looking for, because, you know, you're working class or black or gay or whatever it is, where there's a gap in the archive for whatever, for the reason that people didn't want that bit preserving.
Yeah, or didn't think it was worth preserving.
Yeah, yeah. I know she's written other things and I would definitely read more by her.
Yeah, me too. I think Serpent's Tale might have reissued at least one other of her books. I don't know if both of them, but I would definitely read more, because it is incredibly readable. Incredibly readable, and just brilliant.
Yep, agreed.
Right, tick. Right, okay. Brilliant, move on.
10 out of 10.
No notes. The other book we're talking about, also brilliant, actually, is My Body Keeps Your Secrets by Lucia Osborne Crowley. Right, I'm going to apologise, first of all, because I have to keep reminding myself her name is Osborne Crowley and not Crowley Osborne. And that's because I used to work with someone whose surname was Crowley and then another name. So in my head, like, I just kept giving her the wrong surname. So I apologize to Lucia Osborne Crowley if at any point I get her name the wrong way around, because I just have to keep checking that I'm getting it right. So this was a book that was published in 2021, last year by Indigo Press. I bought this pretty much as soon as it came out, actually. And if you're thinking, oh, her name sounds familiar, since her book came out, I think she's sort of become really well known for a couple of epic Twitter, multiple threads. So she covered the trial of Ghislaine Maxwell, and she covered the trial of Amber Heard and Johnny Depp. And she talked, you know, she was in court and tweeted about both cases in massive detail and wrote about them. And I think she's probably come to a lot of people's notice as a result of those, because it was both of those that, I mean, if God, who knows if Twitter will still be standing by the time that this airs, as you sound like we're actually on television or something. But when we put this podcast on the internet, who knows if Twitter will still be there. It might not be there now, frankly. But God, if Twitter was good for anything, then the kind of her coverage of those trials was exceptional, like completely outstanding. Anyway, this book is about trauma, essentially, and trauma's effect on the body. So she wrote another book, which I didn't actually know about until I read this book. She wrote an earlier book called I Chose Elena, which is her talking about her own experience. She underwent some pretty horrific stuff as a child and young woman. She was sexually abused and she was raped as a 15-year-old, and then went on to suffer from horrendous sort of abdominal pain and various other conditions that were eventually diagnosed as endometriosis and Crohn's disease. And she absolutely roots this back to the abuse and trauma that she suffered. And then what she's done in this book, she does talk about her own story, but she also speaks to a number of young women and non-binary people who have undergone some form of trauma and the effects of which have sort of manifested in their body one way or another, whether that's illness or eating disorders or body image or chronic pain or things like that. And really it's an argument that these, you know, shame in particular, she's talking about, it becomes kind of structural oppression of the body, essentially. And we need to take women, I mean, you know, I'm sure men as well, but primarily women, non-binary people, we need to take their pain seriously and look at the root causes of it. Essentially, I don't know, I think I misrepresented it? That's essentially what it's about, right? Mm.
Yeah, I think I just want to put in there as well that your introduction there serves as a good content note as well for things we might discuss.
Everything. Trigger warning, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some pretty gnarly descriptions in here of eating disorders, self-harm, sexual violence, sexual abuse, coercion, injury, illness. I mean, you name it, that's in here. So, yeah, massive trigger warning on 25 different fronts. But also, don't let that put you off.
No, I will say that, so. One of the things that I'm just going to get this out because I have to do this every time. I always start with the thing that bothered me. One of the things that bothered me was that she doesn't speak to anyone over 37. Now, she gives reasons for that. I'll talk about that in a second. Yeah. However, I wish I'd had this book when I was younger.
Because oh, God, me too.
So much of it. I have turned down so many pages where I was like, yep, that, yep, that, yep, that. Yep. So, yeah, let me just mention that. So she put a call out on Twitter and Instagram and sort of the people that she ended up interviewing were the people who came to her. And I wish she'd spoken to some people who were older, because, you know, one, because I related to quite a lot of it, but also one, some of it I didn't relate to at all, which we'll talk about in a minute. But lots of it I did relate to, and I wanted to hear people who were my age and older talking about partly where they got to, because I think that there's a bit in it where she talks about how she almost wishes she hadn't started trying to work through it all, because it's really hard.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go to her, so she might never listen to this, but if she does, and if anybody else does who's like younger and has started trying to process their like trauma and what it's done to them, it gets better in the sense that you get better at working out what your triggers are and when you're not all right and what to do about it. There was a bit when I sort of thought, no, you don't want to be that person who hasn't started working through it, because that is way more painful.
Yeah.
Actually doing the work, and you like it's incremental and you slide backwards and all of that, but you know,
gotcha.
It's better. It gets better.
Yeah, I mean that was really my only sort of thing with it. I mean we're sitting here as two women in our 40s, so maybe it's unsurprising that we're both like, but what about us? What about us?
I'm not invisible. It's that whole invisible women, middle-aged women thing. I'm like,
yeah, we turned 40 and went invisible. Yeah. But maybe that's because we're not posting selfies, which was the thing that I found. I'm not laughing. That sounds like I was laughing at it. I'm not.
Yeah.
I don't understand the concept of selfies at all. She talks a lot, and lots of people that she talks to in the book are talking about selfies. And my God, I took 40 selfies trying to get this one right. And, you know, it's just a concept that I don't understand. I don't understand why you take pictures of yourself and put them on the internet. Like that just, this maybe is an age thing. Maybe it's, you know, generational in terms of when you're born. I was looking after she said that, obviously it comes up quite, and Instagram comes up in the book a lot, and we're both on Instagram, and I went back and looked through my Instagram, and I think I've got 2 selfies on my whole Instagram. And I remember thinking at the time, one of them's on my 40th birthday, and I remember thinking at the time going, well, this is a bit bloody self-indulgent, isn't it? Like, who actually wants to look at my face? It just as a concept, taking selfies just absolutely bamboozles me. But all of that said, I wish I'd read the book. I wish I'd had the book when I was a lot younger. That said, I don't know if when I was that age, I would have been in a position to recognize that I had gone through trauma, because I don't think I really started processing it or recognizing it until my late 30s.
Right. So 2 things. First one, the selfie thing. One, you sounded exactly like my boyfriend. That was fascinating. He words that in exactly the same way. We're not, like, there's no photos of us together online, because he just will not contemplate it. The selfie thing, it was slightly different for me, because I went through a period. So I do sometimes post selfies, normally when I've had my hair done with lots of different colours in it, which is my favourite thing to do. But I went through a real period of posting selfies and like mirror selfies and stuff that I was wearing, because I was getting divorced. And that was my, like, I don't know, I needed some sort of acknowledgement that I still existed as a human being, I think.
Yeah, I get that. So I did
do that. The thing with the selfies for me was the whole, like, how many they'd take. I mean, not that I'd like take one and just post it. I do take more than one, but like loads all day. How'd you get anything else done? And filters, and then comparing yourself to other people. That was the bit for me and I think that's a generational thing that didn't exist when we were that age, which I thank God for that. I mean, Airbrush magazines, but I don't think for one minute I ever believed that, you know, that I could look like Helena Christensen or whatever.
no, I think that's what becomes actually dangerous then about social media, because we're about what, 4 years apart in age. So our generation, we were teenagers in the sort of early to late 90s, broadly speaking. Yes, it was all magazines for us. We didn't, you know, the internet was just sort of starting when I was a teenager, but it wasn't the kind of thing that everyone had at home. you know, we certainly didn't have social media. We didn't, you know, there was none of that. It was all just magazines or television, I guess. But and of course, it was also the 90s. So it was the height of that kind of heroin chic. It was, you know, Kate Moss and, you know, the incredibly skinny aesthetic. But I think for most people, I'm not saying there wasn't an impact on body image, of course there was, but I think it became a lot easier to distance yourself from that, from some, you know, pictures of someone walking down a runway or a catwalk in Paris that was in, you know, Elle or whatever that you were reading at the time. I didn't read Elle when I was a teenager. What am I talking about? 17 or something, you know, Sugar. remember Sugar? There was Sugar and Shout and Miz and Just 17. And then you sort of got into the realms of Marie Claire and Cosmo and thought you were terribly grown up. Anyway.
Yes, Position of the Fortnight.
Position of the Fortnight was in Miz. Yes, I remember that. I remember also it came with a free book of sexual fantasies, which I had to hide under my mattress because my mother would have been scandalised. Anyway, that's a different podcast. Yeah, but I think it became easy to distance yourself with Instagram. And if you have got a friendship group that are all using filters and posting a million selfies, yes, you start to compare yourself because these are people you know in real life. And that's the danger of it. As a mother of a child who is sort of getting closer to the teenage years by the second and who is about to get her first phone for Christmas, you know, this is the stuff that keeps me up at night, frankly, is like, how do I protect her from that? Because it's so fucking insidious. You know, how do I, at the moment, she couldn't care less, you know, she kind of revels in her weirdness, and frankly, long may that continue. But, you know, she might not one day, she might, you know, be subject to the pressures that so many people are at school. And I'd noticed in this book how much of it sort of started in school and then in university, which is something that we didn't necessarily have to contend with in the same way.
No, I think as well, and I have remembered that I said there was a second point. I'm going to come back to that.
I just started talking.
So when all that was going on, all the heroin chic stuff, I was on the other side of the grunge. So I was always weird at school, but was very much into Hole and Courtney Love and Nirvana and all that sort of side of things. So the other thing that I was thinking about is lots of the stuff that comes up in this book about boys and men at school, so but the boys at school and the comments they're making towards the girls. I had a friendship group that was predominantly boys, and I wonder if that protected me a little bit from that. I mean, I was a bit of a weird kid anyway, and I can't really imagine anyone particularly. I mean, the girls used to bully me, like,
horrendous. Me too, horrendously.
The boys never really commented, and I wonder if that's because of my friendship group. Anyway, the other thing I was going to say about when you said about if you'd had this book when you were like 27 or whatever. No, I was thinking about this when I was reading it. So I went to counselling for the first time when I was 26, I think, and felt like I barely scraped the surface. Like, it didn't occur to me that there was any trauma in my childhood until my marriage ended. And then I had to go, why did I end up in that situation? And then started unpeeling it. So it's been fairly recent for me, really. But even that, you know, I still stand by that it gets easier, even though.
Yeah, I was the same. I first went to therapy when I was in my 20s, but I was still absolutely in that frame of mind of, I'm fine, I'm absolutely fine. Yes, I'm so anxious I can't go out the house, but I'm fine, I'm absolutely fine. It's not my childhood. Yes, it was incredibly chaotic and my mum was an alcoholic and it was, you know, I basically had to bring myself up half the time, but, you know, it was fine. I'm absolutely fine. And I was not, just looking back at it, I'm just like, you were not fine. You were so far from fine. It's absolutely, you know, it wasn't until I was in therapy much more recently, after my mum died, where my therapist said, do you understand that all of the things you're describing to me are childhood trauma and neglect? And I just went, oh yeah, I suppose it is. Yeah, I kind of see that. And I was like 38. of kind of going, oh shit, you know, you kind of look back and go, oh no, some of that stuff was not cool actually. And but then coming back to, I feel like we keep kind of going off tangent from the book, but this is all the stuff that the book brought up for me, that actually I have had chronic pain my entire life, and mostly joint pain, muscle pain. You know, my mum used to take me to the doctor for pain when I was, I was in primary school. I've been in and out of physiotherapy my whole life. I've had God knows what painkillers. But I didn't even know actually that it could be linked to trauma again until the same therapist just went, you know, there's quite a lot of evidence around pain and having suffered trauma, and you go, oh, this is all stuff. Do you know what's coming together? It's all coming together now. And I started to notice a lot more now that, you know, my pain goes up when I'm in times of stress. And you know, you kind of start going, well, maybe that can't all just be just musculoskeletal, you know, bad luck. And yes, I'm fat, which of course is the other thing that stops me going to the doctor about it, because of course someone takes a look at me as a size, you know, 20 odd and going, well, that's why you're in pain. And you kind of go, yeah, not the only reason.
Yeah, I find myself, so I've got bad knees that I've had for years because I started dancing when I was 3 and I danced for 10 years. And they started hurting me when I was in my early 20s and I was a size 10 at that point. But so now every time they hurt, I feel like I have to go, but they hurt when I was really
thin. Yeah. That's the thing when you're fat and have pain, you kind of you feel like you have to prove it so much more. You kind of have to go, oh, I told you, you know, I was 18 and I was a size, you know, 12 to 14. I was still in just as much pain as I am now, God's sake.
What you were just saying, though, again, a couple of things. I've got to remember what they are now because I couldn't remember what one of them was. Most of what you're talking about, I ended up doing myself eventually, that I just went out looking for stuff that to work out what was going on. But I mean, so the thing that I wanted to say was, when you talk about having anxiety, I didn't even have any language for that. And this is one of the things she talks about in the book. So this is what I think was the most powerful thing about this book, was the conversation that I found myself having with it about my own experience, even if I couldn't always relate to the person who was telling their story. Yeah. But she talks about language at one point and whether it's worth having or not. I think she frames it in a slightly different way, but that's basically the conversation, is do you need this language or don't you? And is it helpful or is it not helpful? Well, I had my first panic attack at 13. I had no idea it was a panic attack until I was in my 30s. I didn't know I'd got anxiety until, so you're laughing about finding things out at 38. I was in my 40s when I realized that I have had anxiety my entire life. And I didn't know, I just thought everybody lived like that.
That's the thing.
Like, constant stress.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, and also as women, we're expected to carry so much, and that's something else she talks about in the book. Two things, actually. Firstly, we're just expected to get on with it. We're just always expected to get on with it. But then at the same time, women are supposed to be able to deal with pain. And she talks in the book, and some of it I knew already from other things, but she talks in the book about women being given less analgesic, and then black women even less. So, you know, this is an intersectional issue. Yes, it's much worse for women, it's much worse, much, much worse for black women. Given less analgesic than men, you know, we're supposed to just deal with pain. And the thing is, it made me realize, and I sort of already did know, but reading this sort of really brought it home to me, how much pain I have lived with every day of my adult life. And as I was saying to a friend relatively recently, kind of one day I was, oh, my pain's not too bad today, just kind of a normal amount of pain. And she was just like, you know that no pain is the normal amount of pain. And you're going to go, oh yeah, that's a good point, actually. But yeah, that's how we end up in these cycles. So, I mean, while there were specifics, as you say, about this book that I couldn't necessarily relate to, because, you know, I'm at a different generational point to to the people that interviewed in the book. What it, firstly, there were some specifics that resonated hugely, but also, even if it wasn't the specifics, just the seeing other people acknowledge their pain, whether that be physical pain or emotional pain or whatever, and tracing the roots back and, you know, putting all the jigsaw together. That for me was just like, oh yeah, that's like when I did this. Do you know what I mean? It's yes, I would have loved to read about a woman in their 40s who didn't grow up with Instagram, but that didn't mean I didn't take anything from the book. I took loads from it, and it's, you know, this is a book that's going to live happily on my happily that's the bad worst word used for it. It's going to live on my shelf and be something that I go back to. And also, I mean, something you pointed out when we were talking about this when we started recording, so many of her reference points are women our age or even a bit older.
Yeah, so when I meant to say that, actually, when I was complaining about over 37s, that the people that she quotes are people like Sinead Gleeson, who I love, Deborah Levy. Again, at the very end, she finds out she'd moved into the same apartment block as Deborah Levy, and I was like, oh, I'm right.
Did exactly the same thing. Oh, where is it? Trickle round.
Get on Google. Anne Boyer, Cheryl Strayed. These are all women in their 40s and 50s who've got loads to say about pain, whether it's physical or emotional. Deborah Levy stuff she quotes. Deborah Levy's The Cost of Living. That book crucified me. I read it just after I got divorced, and she's talking about her divorce and what it's cost her to be married and to have been a mother, and it made me sit there and go, oh my god. And it's something that I come back to now. I'm like, right, so this is where things are at. What am I getting from this? What am I giving up? What is, you know what I mean? And I do think about it now in a way that I wouldn't have thought about it before, because there's just that expectation in there, as like you said about women, there's the pain thing, but also there's the expectation that you become a wife and a mother and you crack on. And I'm just like,
completely. Of course, the title of the book, My Body Keeps Your Secrets, and the cover, which you can't see on a podcast, but, you know, Google it. There's obviously a reference there to Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score, which is a book I have owned for a long time and not read. But I did see him speak during the pandemic, actually. There was an online event, and he was absolutely fascinating around just the impact that, you know, psychological trauma has had on the body, and indeed the treatments. We were talking about this before we started, but, you know, research around the good that yoga can do, which I found fascinating. And of course, he was also massively involved in developing, or certainly maybe not developing, but researching the efficacy of EMDR therapy, which is incredible. I don't understand how it works at all, but it seems to be incredibly effective. I'm going to do a massive disclaimer for this is a book I did the publicity for. But there's a book called What My Bones Know by Stephanie Fu. It was published last year, out in paperback in March, fact fans, which is about complex PTSD, and she has EMDR therapy. And it is just sort of mind-blowing to read about it. And actually, if you want to know more about CPTSD and that sort of trauma, I cannot recommend that book highly enough. And not just because I'm a publicist. It was a book that absolutely floored me when I read it before it was, you know, when we were going to publish it. So I leave that recommendation with you as well.
Well, you sent me a copy, so I'll have to get it off my shelf and read it now.
In fact, I wasn't going to say, Naomi.
It's off my shelf because I've had to pull all my bookcases out today to treat my carpets. So actually, it's already off the shelf. I just need to read it now.
Talk about pain in your 40s. What a treatment.
I've got an infestation of carpet moss, which you're all delighted to know, I'm sure. But I was just like, I have multiple bookcases, as you can imagine. So I've had to take everything off the bookcases to be able to pull them out and Hoover and spray and whatever underneath, and I was just like, adulthood's a fucking scam.
What did not sign up for carpet moths.
I know. I felt like I was in Matilda going, what happened to fucking ice cream for breakfast? Like, really? In fact, maybe that should be my reward tomorrow. I'll have ice cream for breakfast.
You should definitely have ice cream for breakfast. can we talk about the BDSM vicar?
Oh, God. It was the one point in the book where I actually gasped out loud because I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, forget your flea bag, like with your hot vicar. Oh, grim.
Yeah, should we explain?
We probably should explain. So there's one of the people she speaks to who is in the BDSM sort of lifestyle, but meets a man on a dating app or an app that's within the lifestyle. And he is horrendous and sort of bullies her into having, well, gives her this weird survey to fill out, first of all, about what kink she is willing to take part in or not. And one of them is consensual non-consent, which is essentially rape fantasy. And she sort of, her immediate reaction is, oh, no. But then doesn't want to, but in this way of women kind of trying to go along and, you know, make nice, she says, well, maybe for the right person, smiley face. Anyway, cut to the chase, and this man raped her. Grim, or just grim. I've just found the page, actually. And she works in a boarding school. One Friday morning, she escorted the girls to the local church. They went to this church once a term, so she was familiar with it, but she wasn't religious herself. The girls filed in and sat through the service, which included a sermon. They listened. The older ones giggled, the younger ones stared up deferentially, and they filed out. As she walked with the girls, Charlie caught one side of a familiar face standing in the doorway, facing outside so she could only see part of his profile. As if feeling her gaze, the face turned towards her, and then she was sure it was her rapist in a vicar's robes. Averting her eyes, hoping he wouldn't notice, Charlie turned to a woman near her who worked at the church. Who's that? She asked the woman. Oh, that's the vicar of our parish. We adore him. He and his wife and children spend half their lives in this church. There. Grim.
Yeah. It reminded me that she quotes Hannah Gadsby when she says, yes, she doesn't hate men, she's just scared of them.
Absolutely.
That did remind me though of something else that I wanted to mention, because you said about a meeting on that app, and Osborne Crowley talks about dating apps and that being the only sort of place to meet people, and how that sort of turbocharges relationships or sex or whatever's happening. And I at that point, I wanted to scream at the book, you don't have to use the dating apps. You don't. And I only say that because I met my boyfriend in my local pub. But it's still possible. It's still possible. I think people need to know that, like, you can meet people other places.
Again, I think it's a generational thing, isn't it? I mean, I remember I've got a few friends who met people on Guardian Soulmates.
Oh, right. Which
was before the apps, but like when online dating in the sort of early 2000s, I guess. And that was like a real kind of, we don't actually want to tell any people that we met on Guardian Soulmates. We don't want to be online dating, God. And now it's completely de rigueur. And frankly, the whole concept terrifies me. It's, no. I don't want any part of it.
Well, I did, and ended up in an emotional abusive relationship. So that is why I am no longer on any apps.
No, fair. There's been a few times with younger colleagues down the pub, a couple of them have been on dating apps, and after drink was taken, I mean, not, I don't drink, but swept up in the atmosphere. they've sort of like passed their phone over and go, oh, can you swipe for me? And I found it absolutely fascinating. And there was one night, I won't name anyone involved, obviously, but there was a straight man and a straight woman who both were on, I don't know if it was the same app, but similar apps. And looking through the women on my straight male colleague's account, I mean, these women were just, so many of them were jaw-droppingly stunning, had obviously put a huge amount of thought into their profiles and all this sort of stuff. And then looking at the straight men on my straight female colleague, and you're just like, these are the dregs of humanity. These, this is awful. It's just awful. And it was just, it was a very stark contrast, shall we say.
But do you find that when you're walking about the street, that you walk past a straight couple and you're just like, yeah.
You are punching above your weight, my friend.
See, I sort of don't believe in that concept, but also I just go, look, like, and I think it's partly that thing about how much effort we make as women to like how we look when we leave the house, which I suppose is our sort of, I don't, maybe that's our Instagram equivalent, is done up or whatever. And then, you know, the woman's always like, you know, beautiful, and then you just like, bloke looks like he's just got out of bed and pulled on yesterday's shirt or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
And same pair of jeans is worn for months.
Oh. Awful. I mean, the other thing I wanted to mention about this, and again, it's all stuff you kind of know, but it's when you see it in story after story after story, is a number of times that the people that she spoke to have been gaslighted by people. Mm. It's kind of, it kept making me think, you know, this idea of plausible deniability, that these small things would happen and you can write them off because it's just that one time, or it's just this, or maybe I misread that signal, or maybe I didn't quite understand this in the right way. And I think particularly as women, we are so quick to find fault in our own version of events, I think. It's not until it all adds up and you stand back and look at the bigger picture when you go, oh, there's no, this is actually quite a big deal. And actually seeing that pattern in so many of the people that she spoke to just time and time and time again, again, made me think of my own life and things that I've kind of turned a blind eye to, or, oh no, it can't possibly, he wouldn't have meant that. I'm sure, you know, that wasn't his intention. So many, you know, you get so, I think so many people get away with so much in the kind of, well, what was the intention though? Doesn't have to be the intention if the consequence is still the same. Have to keep remembering that.
Yep.
I'm just turning this into a therapy session for me. I hope you don't mind.
No, I felt exactly the same way about that. And that's it, isn't it? I was reading it, thinking about so many things that I'd allowed, well, no, that, see I'm doing it there, I'd allowed to happen, did either somebody else did them to me, it was, but there we are.
I do really, really recommend both books. Both have some pretty grim details in them, which you should be aware of, but I think they're both books that go a long way towards reclamation of various types. So, next week.
More trauma.
We need a new like subtitle for the podcast. Late to it. All the trauma we've been reading. next week, we are talking about Educated by Tara Westover. Not an inconsiderable amount of trauma in that book. And The Incendiaries by R.O. Kwon. So a mixture of fiction and non-fiction next week. Yes.
Is that my cue?
That's your cue. I was about to look, but in the meantime, I was like, I don't know if we say that.
You could do it if you want.
No, you're all right. On you go.
In the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow Kirsty on Twitter because she's still on there until it burns, at the other Kirsty. Yeah, you mentioned Instagram earlier, but I'm like, I keep my Instagram private. So I'm like, you can try and follow me on there and I might reject you. But I'm at Naomi Frisbee and Kirsty is at Other Kirsty. No,
yeah, there's the Other Kirsty was already gone on Instagram. So The Other Kirsty on Twitter and Other Kirsty on
why
Instagram.
Are you the Other Kirsty?
I'll tell you why. This probably doesn't need to be for the I'm sure the podcast audience don't necessarily find this
I
interesting.
I think they deserve to know.
They do. It's because back in ye olde blogging days, when I was ye olde blogger, when people used to comment on each other's blogs, do you remember that? In the sort of 2000s, before Instagram, there was another blog that I used to comment on quite a lot, and they would comment on my blog quite a lot, and so kind of got quite friendly. You know, that was a group blog. There was several of them all wrote for that blog, and one of the people that wrote for that blog was also called Kirsty. And so I used to comment on their blog as the Other Kirsty because I was not the Kirsty that wrote for them. And it just stuck. And so when Twitter started and various other social media platforms, I just used the Other Kirsty as my username and it's just sort of stayed with me. So now it sounds terribly self-deprecating, but it was actually originally for a very practical reason.
And now we all know. Thank you.
There you go.
We'll leave you with that. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.